you see, like, Imam Hussein's, what was Imam Hussein's perspective of life?
Well, you know, it's a very strange thing. You know, we have been living with the concept of Ashura for too long. I mean, ever since we've been born.
Too long?
Yes, of course. Ever since we've been born, we have, as we are in a religious country, and we have these gatherings and ceremonies in which we talk about our beloved ones that are the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Well, we grow up with the idea of knowing more and more about them. Now,
right.
In the process of getting to know them, we come across with the Imam Hussein and all the sacrifice he already has done in the field of Karbala.
Okay.
Well, we see that when he is coming out of his hometown, when he is getting in the way of Karbala, before that, he has some sort of very interesting speech that has got a lot of importance and a lot of important concepts inside of it.
Like what?
In his speech, he mentions something about the ways of life that has been changed.
Okay.
He says that life is changing, and to me, dying in dignity is way better than living in humiliation.
Wow.
Which is a very interesting concept. Now, for such a man to come to this conclusion and make it pretty much clear for all of us that living is dignity is all that matters in life is very important matter to understand and to note it. Because, you know, even right now that we're living in a modern age, everything has turned topsy-turvy.
Mm-hmm.
So things are not the same way as they were. Things have changed their meanings. Everything has got a wrong connotation. And those things that used to be right no longer sound as right. And even if you practice them, you would be considered as sort of very strange, odd people.
Yeah.
So we could take that lesson from him as one of his perspectives regarding life, that he has never yelled to oppression.
Okay.
And he always believed in dignity for human beings.
All right. So you said death with dignity is far better than living with humiliation.
Yeah, of course.
I'll be continuing this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We are discussing Imam Hussein's perspective of life. Brother Najafi, what do you say about that?
Right, so if you're talking about life itself, it has to be defined for us to understand what perspective Imam alayhi salatu wasalam had for life.
True.
There's a verse in the Quran that says, يَا أَيُّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اسْتَجِيبُوا لِلَّهِ وَلِلرَّسُولِ إِذَا دَعَاكُمْ لِمَا يُحْيِيكُمْ. O those who've brought faith, respond to the call of Allah and His Prophet. What's going to happen when you respond to the call? Lima yuhyikum. Right? That response, if you respond to the call of Allah and the Prophet, it's going to bring life to you. You're going to be alive, right? But there's a question here. The people who've brought faith are people who walk, who talk, who eat, who sleep. These people live, right?
Yeah.
And it's a question in our mind. If someone's already alive, why are you telling this person that if you do this and that, you'd be given life? Is a question. This question gives us an answer in itself. This question, it's a statement.
Okay.
It's telling us that life, according to Quran, isn't just a standard
eating,
base.
Walking, you know, sleeping.
Yeah. Certainly, different types of life is in perspective here.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about perspective, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam's perspective of life isn't this base life that we're talking about.
All right.
Right? It's certainly far beyond that life.
It has a greater cause.
Certainly it does. It has a cause. But I might be swirling here and there, but like I'll come back to where we're talking. Like Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in Dua Arafah says, Amiyat aynun la tarak. I that does not see you is blind.
It's blind.
It's better be blind,
right?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's blind.
Yeah.
It's blind.
It's blind. It's literally blind, right? What does that mean? Does it mean that it doesn't see tangible objects? No. You know?
Yeah.
So there are degrees to being having a vision, yeah. right? Similarly, there are degrees to having a life, mm-hmm. right? So a life that I'd say is a life when I'm submitting to oppression or wrongdoing and I'm there standing, watching and not doing anything is not considered as life in the eyes of Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam.
So Asma, mm-hmm. coming back to you, you said Imam Hussein alayhi salam said living with dignity is mm-hmm. what he prefers. Well, you know, as Brother Najafi also put it, we see that Imam Hussein alayhi salam says the one who does not see Allah in his life or who does not see him as a caretaker, basically, is a blind eye.
Yeah.
And so we see Allah in his entire life, like mm-hmm. we see Allah from the beginning and end of his life. Whenever we see or whenever yeah. we read his quotes, we see it's about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or worshipping him or praising him. What is his concept about worshipping?
Well, as just the brother mentioned, the important thing is that the main part in Imam Hussein's life and totally Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam is God himself. So yeah. they bring him into the core of their life and they do act accordingly. So about the worshipping that you just mentioned, I would say that
just as Brother said, like there are so many people who live, who sleep, who eat,
yeah,
who drink,
yeah.
and but they as of have life. But Imam Hussein's perspective of life is something else. In the
because
same way, Imam has different perspective about worshipping God.
Yeah. Yeah, because people do have different meanings of life.
Yeah.
We could all have the same life, but we are not going to live it in the same way. So this precious thing is given to us, but the entire meaning out of this is to worship Allah.
Yeah.
And now that we were just speaking of perspective, I just remembered a nice a quote from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He was telling different sorts of living. Those people who live and worship God for the benefit there's people who live and worship Allah and they have in their mind that they would get to heaven.
Yeah.
So the thing that they want out of their worshiping is just getting to heaven.
Yeah.
This is the kind of a thing that a trade man would do.
The worship of traders.
Yeah, the worship of traders. And then we have those people who worship Allah just in fear. Just out
the fear
of fear
of hell.
Yes. Just out of fear of hell, they do that worshipping, which is also not a
the
sort
worship
of very...
worship of slaves.
Yeah, that is worship of slaves and is not very nice and recommended to everyone. The last one, which is the very satisfying sort of worshipping, best form of worshiping is the one that you do it because you know that God is worthy of that worship.
Yeah. So because, and that's the worship of the free.
Yeah. That's the worship of the free people who do that just for the favor of getting closer to Allah. I guess that is what Imam Hussein alayhi salam meant.
He's teaching
to
us.
Yes, yeah. Yes. The journey he made from Mecca to Karbala is actually the thing that is according to this code and is telling us that life is not just a matter that you do it in order to get to heaven or in order to just not to go to hell. It's something beyond that. You should get closer to Allah and have that link and connection.
So it's interesting that you mentioned freedom, right?
Yeah.
Even in terms of worship, because on the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam, when he's surrounded by those people, he says this to them. He says, "In lam yakul lakum din, fakunu ahraran fi dunyakum."
Yeah, that's very nice.
Right? If you do not believe in the hereafter, at the very least, be freemen in this world that you live in, right?
Yeah.
Free, right? So worship in itself, in the eyes of Imam Hussein, is life. Life equals worship. Worship equals life.
Yeah.
Right? Every action that he performs, every, in terms of eating, every morsel that he eats is worship, not just ritualistic worship.
Yeah. Well, Brother Najaf, you gave it a beautiful connotation. Thank you so much, guys, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. We were talking about Imam Hussein al-Islam's perspective of life. Until another session, fi amanullah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the UK, but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now whilst I'm at work to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent. It does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine.
The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs, which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Saeed Puriza, London.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of two decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory. Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Mid-August this year marked the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the U.S. missile withdrawal from the country, after 2 decades of military presence. The last year U.S.-led evacuation turned violent and tragic, during which many Afghan people lost their lives. Sports champion Muhammad John, who was shot dead at the Kabul airport, was one of the victims. His parents blamed the U.S. for the tragic incident and are seeking compensation for the loss of their boy.
The U.S. and its allies are 100% to blame for the martyrdom of our beloved ones at the airport because they invited people and gave them hope of getting them out of Afghanistan. The U.S. not only did not provide the people with security, but also opened fire on them. They killed and injured at least 400 people, including my son. We are waiting for compensation from those who committed the crime.
The U.S. 2-decade invasion of Afghanistan ended with the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops from Kabul last year. However, Afghans say Washington has started another war against them, a dangerous economic war. Since the Taliban's return to power on August 15, 2021, the U.S. has frozen nearly $9 billion in Afghanistan foreign reserves and cut off major international funding. The sanctions have pushed Afghanistan's economy to the brink of collapse, with 97% of Afghans living in poverty. Afghan people and international bodies have been calling for the release of funds so that the country could cope with the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
The impacts of the U.S. seizure of Afghan assets have not been less than the damages of their 20-year war. When the U.S. sanctions were imposed on Afghanistan, the fragile economy started to shrink. Banking system crashed and people went out of cash. The money they had on their hands lost its value. Today, 1 year on, the conditions are deepening, so the U.S. and the international communities are obliged to unfreeze the assets and let the flow of aid to the country.
Meanwhile, violence and bloodshed have continued under the Taliban. The country saw a rise in deadly attacks against the Shia community last year, mostly carried out by the Daesh terrorist group. 1 year into the Taliban's return to power, Afghans are still grappling with multiple crises. However, they are happy that the U.S. occupation of their country has ended. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bow-tie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals. And in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers. But French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Kashmir is decorated with Indian flags as India is marking its 75th Independence Day anniversary. Government offices, schools, colleges, official vehicles, roads and streets in and around Kashmir were decorated with the Indian flag as part of a government-led nationwide campaign dubbed Tricolor in Every Home. In Srinagar's Sher-e-Kashmir Stadium, Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the Indian tricolor in the presence of government officials.
Anudana hopes and dreams is here. Since August 2019, the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is scripting history and is recording unprecedented performance in every sector.
The administration in Kashmir took stringent security measures to ensure a smooth flag hoisting ceremony. Barbed wires were stretched across roads, guarded by security forces to avoid the breach of security or any militant attack. Shops and business establishments were closed and traffic remained largely suspended. But prominent politicians in Kashmir say holding such celebrations in Kashmir only hurts the sentiments of the people of Kashmir and is just rubbing salt in the wounds after what they call India's illegal move of scrapping Kashmir's special status on August 5, 2019.
Post-abrogation of Article 317, New Delhi has not been fair to the people of Kashmir. It was a death of democracy. People's wishes and aspirations were not considered. The unfurling of the tricolor in the city center by a handful of people amid tough security is not what we call normality. If it was normal, people would have participated in large numbers, and this is what the government of India needs to address.
He added, in the absence of political process, people of Kashmir seem to have lost all rights and have been silenced. The decisions are taken without taking people on board.
On August 5, 2019, New Delhi abrogated Kashmir's special status and divided the region into two parts, calling it integrating the region with the rest of India. Experts say if India wants to win over the hearts of Kashmiri people, instead of imposing decisions, India must start addressing the concerns of people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Meet Trira, the latest crossover car produced by Iran's giant automaker, Iran Khodro. The vehicle was unveiled at Iran Khodro's factory west of Tehran. The Iranian automaker says this is the first crossover ever built in Iran, which can compete with international rivals. Iranian automakers, namely Iran Khodro and Saipa, have picked up the slack after Francis Peugeot and Renault, along with other international automotive companies, exited Iran in 2018, in the wake of U.S. sanctions on Tehran that created a supply crunch, pushing car prices to unprecedented highs. The crisis forced Iranian companies to produce Iranian-made vehicles. While admitting the adverse effects of U.S. sanctions, Iran Khodro Managing Director Mehdi Khatibi said the measures have had their silver lining.
We don't agree with sanctions. We favor free international trade. However, sanctions helped us become an automaker, and today I should tell you that Iran Khodro is a respectable and reliable car producer in the world.
Iranian-made cars already roll on the streets of countries such as Iraq, Syria, Azerbaijan, and Senegal. However, Iran Khodro has higher ambitions, planning to export 100,000 cars each year.
In Turkmenistan, we have exported our buses. Our new market will be North Africa, especially Tunisia, where we have already presented our Rona model. We will also resume exporting to Venezuela and Armenia. And all this have come despite U.S. sanctions.
Launched in 1966, Iran Khodro Industrial Group, or shortly IKCO, started by producing the first Iranian-made car, Paycon, based on Britain's Hillman Hunter in the 1960s. Paycon was discontinued in 2005. Some of the old-fashioned cars, such as Peugeot 206, are still rolling off the production lines of Iran Khodro. However, the Iranian car maker says it will soon stop producing them. It plans to focus on manufacturing luxury cars such as Rira, which it regards as a bridge toward a foothold in the global market.
With all the ups and downs, Iran Khodro has come a long way from copying foreign designs to manufacturing its own cars. However, the Iranian automaker says it's not complacent with where it stands and will continue its journey toward making cars on par with international brands. Yusuf Jalalip, Tehran.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year. Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place. The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face because that would just be, that would just be very...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S. Western Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims, says Ramzi Baruch, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Why Normalization with the Israeli Regime Will Fail. Stay tuned for more. It seemed all but a done deal. The Israeli regime is finally managing to bend the Arabs to its will, and Palestine is becoming a marginal issue that no longer defines the Zionist regime's relations with Arab countries. Indeed, normalization with the Zionist regime is afoot, and the Arabs, so it seems, have been finally tamed. Not so fast. Many events continue to demonstrate the opposite. Take, for example, the Arab League two-day meeting in Cairo on July 31st to August 1st. The meeting was largely dominated by discussions on Palestine and concluded with a statement that called on Arab countries to reactivate the Arab boycott of the Israeli regime until the latter abides by international law. The strongest language came from the League's Assistant Secretary General, who called for solidarity with the Palestinian people by boycotting companies that support the Zionist regime's occupation. The two-day conference of the liaison officers of the Arab regional offices on the boycott of the Zionist regime praised the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, which has been under intense Western pressures for its unrelenting advocacy of international action against the fake regime of Israel. One of the recommendations by Arab officials was to support Arab boycott initiatives in accordance with the Tunis Arab Summit in March 2019, which resolved that boycott of the Israeli regime occupation and its colonial regime is one of the effective and legitimate means to resist. Though one may rightly cast doubts on the significance of such statements in terms of dissuading the Zionist regime from its ongoing colonization schemes in Palestine, at least it demonstrates that in terms of political discourse, the collective Arab position remains unchanged. This was also expressed clearly to U.S. President Joe Biden during his latest visit to the West Asia region. Biden may have expected to leave the region with major Arab concession to the Zionist regime, which would be considered a significant political victory for the pro-Israel members of his Democratic Party prior to defining November midterm elections, but he received none. What American officials do not understand is that Palestine is a deeply rooted emotional, cultural, and spiritual issue for Arabs and Muslims. Neither Biden nor Donald Trump and Jared Kushner before him could easily or possibly alter that. Indeed, anyone who is familiar with the history of the centrality of Palestine in the Arab discourse understands that Palestine is not a mere political question that is governed by opportunism, an immediate political or geopolitical interest. Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S., Western, Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims. Political platitudes aside, the Palestinian struggle for freedom remains a recurring theme in Arab poetry, art, sports, religion, and culture in all its manifestations. This is not an opinion, but a demonstrable fact. The latest Arab Center, Washington, D.C., ACW public opinion poll examined the views of 28,288 Arabs in 13 different countries. Majority of the 350 million Arabs continue to hold the same view as previous generations of Arabs did, as Palestine is a cause and the Zionist regime is the main threat. The Arab Opinion Index, AOI, of late 2020 is not the first of its kind. In fact, it is the seventh such study to be conducted since 2011. The trend remains stable. All the U.S.-Israeli plots and bribes to sideline Palestine and the Palestinians have failed, and despite purported diplomatic successes, they will continue to fail. According to the poll, vast majority of Arabs, about 81%, oppose U.S. policy towards Palestine. 89% and 81% believe that the Israeli regime and the U.S. respectively are the largest threat to their individual country's national security. Particularly important, majority of Arab respondents insist that the Palestinian cause concerns all Arabs and not simply the Palestinians. This includes 89% of Saudis and 88% of Qataris. Arabs may disagree on many issues, and they do. They might stand at opposite sides of regional and international conflicts, and they do. They might even go to war against one another, and sadly, they often do. But Palestine remains the exception. For Arabs, Palestine is also a personal and intimate subject. Numerous Arab households have framed photos of Arab martyrs who were killed by the Zionist regime during previous wars or were killed fighting for Palestine. This means that no amount of normalization or even outright recognition of the Zionist regime by an Arab country can wash away the Zionist regime's sordid past or menacing image in the eyes of ordinary Arabs. A most telling example of this is how Egyptians and Jordanians answered the AOI question, "Would you support or oppose diplomatic recognition of Israel by your country?" The interesting thing about this question is that both Cairo and Amman already recognized the Zionist regime and have diplomatic ties with Tel Aviv since 1979 and 1994, respectively. Still to this day, 93% of Jordanians and 85% of Egyptians still oppose that recognition as if it never took place. The argument that Arab public opinion carries no weight in non-democratic societies neglects the fact that every form of government is predicated on some form of legitimacy, if not through a direct vote. It is through other means. Considering the degree of involvement the cause of Palestine carries in every aspect of Arab societies, on the street, in the mosques and church, in universities, sports, civil society organizations and much more, this owning Palestine would be a major delegitimizing factor and a risky political move. American politicians who are constantly angling for quick political victories on behalf of the Zionist regime in the West Asia region do not understand or simply do not care about marginalizing Palestine and incorporating the Zionist regime into the Arab body politic. It's not simply unethical, but also a major destabilizing factor in an already unstable region. Historically, such attempts have failed, and often miserably so, as apartheid Israeli regime remains as hated by those who normalized as much as it is hated by those who have not. Nothing will ever change that, as long as Palestine remains an occupied country.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa maulana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, on IRIB English Radio. One of the personalities that, unfortunately, within the English language, there is not a lot of material on, is a person who played a great role. Again, obviously, historical discussions need to be analyzed a bit further. But in general, a role before the event of Karbala, and a role especially, and more importantly, after the event of Karbala. And that person is Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. And we all know of the serial that was produced regarding this individual, a serial that has a lot of important historical instances and incidents and anecdotes in it. Obviously not everything in a serial, series is true. Obviously, they had to make it to look like that. But there are a lot of important things within it that are very historically accurate. But unfortunately, in written English, there's very few sources. One of the first books that I myself came across with this topic is the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today, inshallah. And it's a book, again, as the culture of, you know, the majalis and of the gatherings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is, many of these gatherings that the scholar delivers lectures and delivers the speech, they are then, you know, recorded, they are then, you know, typed and set into a written form. So the book that we would like to introduce, similar to the one we introduced in one of our previous programs, is a set of lectures that were then compiled, collected, and then translated into English. So inshallah, Please join us for the introduction of this book in our next segment, inshallah.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd. Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name? Is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Amir Mukhtar Rahmatullah Alayh, Lectures of Shah e Karbala Trust, Imam Baghi Rizviya Society. And these lectures were delivered in the year 1998. These lectures were delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi, and they were then translated by Dur Shahwar Jafari. And obviously, from the title and from the place of the lectures, we can quite easily understand that the original language of these lectures were Urdu. The book was then published by Mahfuz Book Agency, which is also based in Karachi, Pakistan, obviously. So basically, this book is a set of 9 lectures that were delivered by the author at that particular Imam Baghi. Or the Imam Baghi obviously is Husseiniya, or a place or a center where the gatherings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is performed, or where people gather in order to remember the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So the author obviously, in the beginning of his lecture, speaks about the history of Mukhtar Rahmatullah alayhi. He gives the history of before Karbala, after Karbala, and what Mukhtar did after Karbala. And obviously at the end of each lecture, he does the maqtal, or the reciting of the mourning and reciting of the events of Karbala in order to make people cry. So in this particular book as well, you see that the author will obviously start with the history and then continue throughout the lectures on the history, and then obviously go to the reciting of the heart-rending events of Karbala, but obviously referring it back to some of the events that are relevant to the title of Mukhtar. And as I mentioned, this is one of the first books that I myself came across that deals with the subject. There is another book that deals with this, but it's a very smaller book, and hopefully, inshallah, in one of our next sessions, we will be able to introduce that book, which is also about Mukhtar al-Thaqafi, to our dear listeners. But right now, this is a book that we want to introduce. Again, it is called Amir Mukhtar. It is a set of 9 lectures that have been translated from Urdu to English, delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi and translated by Dur Shahwar Jafari. And obviously, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Amir Mukhtar, Rahmatullah Alayh, a set of 9 lectures that were delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi in Pakistan, obviously originally delivered in Urdu, translated into English then by Dur Shahwar Ja'fari, and then published in Karachi by Mahfuz Book Agency. So we will be reading from the first lecture, obviously, because these lectures kind of flow from one another, so it will not be beneficial to start from example lecture 3 and then only leave out the rest of them. So the recital begins with the following verse of the Holy Quran from Surah Ahzab, Surah 33, verse number 23. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them some have completed their vow and some await, but they have never changed in the least. Dear audience, the topic is before you. Inshallah, I shall be talking to you about Amir Mukhtar for 9 days. Today is the introductory speech. I have to tell you certain things. Firstly, the reason for the selection of this topic. Usually it happens that the discussion about Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, is left for the end, i.e. in Rabi al-Awwal. Even then, only Mukhtar Nameh is read. In a way, that is also fulfilling the obligation. However, the reason I had in mind when I selected this topic was that Muharram is at its peak. During the first month and up till the Chahlum means the 40th after the day of Ashura, basically the Arba'in. There is more fervor. After the Chahlum, it is natural that as the days of mourning are towards the end, by the 8th of Rabi al-Awwal, the mourning ends. One can see by the crowd in the procession that mu'mineen are busy in the programs planned after 8th of Rabi al-Awwal. That is why, in my humble opinion, the jihad of Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, cannot be given due importance during those days. Respected Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, the great historical character, don't see him only as a prediction and prayer of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Mawla-i Kainat, alayhi salam, that is Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam, and Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, and think that it is the only reason that we have to talk about him. Dear audience, in order to get a proper historical perspective, we shall have to enter the atmosphere prevailing in the Kufa of those days. We shall have to reach the people of that era. It is not that the Kufa were a weird nation. Nowadays, whoever breaches faith is called a Kufi. It has almost become a metaphor. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly understand the personality of Mukhtar with research. Again, this book is based on the research and the opinions of this humble Sayyid. May Allah subhanahu bless his efforts. And may we also be of those who partake in the gatherings of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and truly understand the personalities who played a great role in this historical and unique and unmatched event. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB.